to make their opening remarks. After that, they'll have 3 to 5 minutes to respond to each other, and then we will spend the rest of the time doing Q&A as before. So, the description is as follows. In her seminal 1900 pamphlet, Reform or Revolution, Rosa Luxemburg stated that if the socialist movement lost sight of its final goal, there would be nothing to distinguish it from liberal politics. Yet she also claimed that the desiderata of liberalism could only be fulfilled through the struggle for socialism. Though still widely read, Luxemburg's critique has only grown more enigmatic as the relationship of these two competing ideologies blurred in the 20th century. The 1930s Popular Front alliance of communist parties and liberals, initially conceived as a temporary strategy to defeat fascism, proved to be a lasting reformist coalition. Socialism regressed from a politics of social revolution to a seemingly more radical version of the liberal protest against exploitation and oppression. When the working class and its trade union leadership began to lose their radical veneer, the 1960s New Left sought new revolutionary subjects in the social movements coalescing around race, gender, and sexuality, which seemed to offer radicalism surpassing the liberal labor lines of the time. Yet the 70s saw the integration of the New Left into the political establishment by way of the Democratic Party, paralleling the fate of the communists. Now, liberals champion the new social movements, to which socialists ostensibly oppose a class-first perspective. In the recent election, Clinton represented the neoliberal establishment, which opposed identity politics to the working class concerns voiced by Sanders. For Clinton supporters, the Sandernistas were brochureists who reduced the problems of society to economics, neglecting other forms of oppression. So the questions were, how do both camps fall short of the fulfillment of all liberal desiderata? What would it take for a left to define itself beyond liberal politics? In what ways is the contemporary left's relation to the Democratic Party a legacy of previous capitulations to liberalism? How has the lack of a self-conscious left opened the way for aggressive movements to fill the void of emancipatory politics? And finally, how can the left oppose the establishment parties without simply replacing them? And I'll invite Mel to begin.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out, and thanks to the platypus for organizing the meeting, which is going to be very successful. I'm going to speak very briefly on some external historical phenomena which relate to liberalism and socialism. I'm not going to address the question of Clinton versus Sanders, but maybe that will come out in discussion afterwards from the floor. And maybe in my comrades' presentation. Exactly. But I'll try and be brief because I'm not going to show in much detail. I'm going to leave it to them to add the substance to what I say abstractly. So let's start with politics because we're dealing with liberal politics and socialist politics. Politics is the struggle over which class or class alliance or class fraction dominates the state or block of states that controls a particular social, economic, and usually geographic region. So that's my definition of politics. Politics in the modern period depends on and mirrors class relationships. That's my major thesis. Current period class structure occurs within the general framework of capitalism, in which the capitalist class is hegemonic. Its dominance extends beyond the political sphere into the economic, social, and cultural realm. However, this dominance isn't usually absolute, which permits other classes or class fractions to express their interests. All the currently significant classes, capitalists, peasants, intermediate layers, such as the petty bourgeois, existed prior to capitalists emerging as the principal mode of organizing society. Their specific characteristics and relations reflect the specific development of capitalism as a dominant world order. Since capitalism itself is itself dynamic, reflecting the development of the force of production, in particular, technological advancement, class relationships are dynamic, changing their specific modes and forms. The assembly line work with the auto plant 50 years ago was culturally and socially different from the physical therapist working in a rehab center today, as is the relationship between the auto worker and his foreman and the therapist and her supervisor, although both reflect the worker-management relation characteristic captains. Thus, since class relations are dynamic and sometimes fluid, it follows that politics within capitalism are dynamic and sometimes fluid, despite the ruling class in capitalism is always a capitalist. Socialism and liberalism form two of the most important politics of the 20th century. Before that, even the 19th century, we're only concentrating on the 20th century. There were other important politics, such as fascism, anti-colonial movements, peasant-based politics, politics based on the interests of large landowners who propose the right wing of capitalism. But we consider here only the class based of socialism, liberalism. Socialism as a mass movement began in the 19th century as the European workers movement aimed at explicitly transcending capitalism. It reached a high point in Western Europe, particularly in Germany, prior to World War I, organizationally the German Social Democratic Party, but also grew into workers' major political parties in France, England, the US, Italy, and Russia. But World War I split the movement. The dominant faction in all these parties, except for the Russian party, abandoned the anti-war international and solidarity politics that it pledged to uphold, and entered into a coalition with their national bourgeoisie to support their country in war. World War I ignited a revolutionary movement in Russia, which, with the international anti-war wing of the Russian Social Democratic Party, the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin, gained the leadership. The revolution turned into a civil war, successfully won under the Bolshevik leadership, and then formed the revolutionary government. The dominant class force in the new regime were the workers, but Lenin from the beginning, acknowledging the working class constitute a minority of the laboring classes, defined the politics of the new regime as based on a worker-peasant alliance, and not a pure worker state. This is an example of a real example of the kind of politics and states that are likely to grow out of any revolutionary movements. Not necessarily the working peasant alliance, but an alliance of the working class and other forces. The Russian Revolution generated a wave of revolutionary socialist movements throughout the world. This was the basis of the founding of the Third International, consisting of the revolutionary wings of the old Social Democratic Party. The established leadership of the old party opposed the formation of the Soviet Union, thus breaking with revolutionary socialist politics. These old social democrats continued to claim leadership of the working class, but very quickly signed up to the campaign of international campaign of capital to destroy the Soviet Union. This, in turn, led to politically block with domestic capital in the hope of gaining and consolidating a place within the bourgeois governments. And this was operated in the line of Bernstein, the World War I German social democrat, who argued that socialism would flow automatically from bourgeois democracy, a position that had been rejected by all social democratic parties was capitulation of socialism to capitalism. This line of the orthodox pre-World War I Marxists proved absolutely correct, as these parties, the new social democratic parties, even prior to World War II, and definitely afterwards, gave up even a verbal commitment to socialism and working class rule, and entered into a permanent alliance with a section of the capitalists, willing to entertain certain social reform to escape the political consequences of the worldwide depression and defeat fascism. This alliance laid the basis of initially with the New Deal in the U.S. in World War II in Western Europe, for liberalism to become the dominant political arrangements in the advanced capitalist world. Promoted as an alliance between the educated layers of the working class and the dynamic forward-looking wing of the capitalist class, its purpose was to consolidate a rational and up-to-date capitalism by curtailing both the forces of fascism, a particularly brutal and illicit form of capitalist rule, and defeating the threat of some threatening challenge of a revived workers' movement. Thus, liberalism represented a politics of the section, in fact, the dominant section of the ruling class, with a subordinate role for the remnants of the organized working class, which had repudiated any real struggle for workers' political power, that is, for socialism. This politics remained dominant for 40 years in the advanced capital world, until it proved inadequate to deal with economic stagnation and falling profits, along with the challenge of an anti-imperialist movement in the third world. This challenge was organized under an alliance of national bourgeoisie and radicalized peasants, with the active participation of radicalized workers, who were a minority, under the leadership of the communist parties, which professed the socialist and internationalist politics, the children of the revolutionary workers' movement inspired by the Bolshevik Revolution. These movements took a particularly revolutionary character in China, Vietnam, and Cuba, where they attained state power with a professed aim of liquidating capitalism and building a socialist society. And this presented a particular challenge to capitalist international hegemony. They also inspired a revolutionary trend among youth in the capitalist centers, which reached its high point in the French uprising of 1968. Along with a revolutionary current of youth of color, particularly in the US, which were inspired by the anti-imperialist movements in the third world. These political and economic challenges, along with the military defeat of the US and Vietnam, proved the inadequacy of the liberal alliance to resolve the difficulties confronting capital, international, locally and international, and give way to a more right-wing political combine. Reaganism in the US, Thatcher in England, which aimed at liquidating the welfare state and eliminating the remnants of social democracy that participated in governing. The trade union chiefs were driven from the table in DC and London. And the previous political elites were forced to adopt an unquestioned belief that only the capitalist market provided a rational guide to economic activity. And the role of the state was to advance the economic power of the capitalist class, restructuring product and financial markets so that all economic power was to pass into the hands of giant financial industrial monopolies which control the capitalist markets. Thus, neoliberalism was constructed as a dominant economic force. The dominant political figures, in particular those that emerged from the traditional liberal combine, such as Clinton from the leadership of the Democratic Party and Blair from the Labor, were forced to swear allegiance to the new dogma of neoliberalism as the price of leading their prospective governments. Neoliberalism represented the passing of the older liberal coalition to the new organization of the capitalist world, which is almost the entire world of economic relevance. The traditional liberals remain and dream of reconstructing the older liberal area. This is politically and economically impossible, but even if it were possible, it would be wrong and even reactionary for socialists who strive to construct a workers-dominated socialist political order, the historic mission of socialism, to promote a revival of liberalism. Whatever the positive aim of such a coalition, is no longer capable in the current stage of capitalism. We have not discussed the tragic collapse of the revolutionary socialist policy, which was constituted out of the ferment generated by the Bolshevik Revolution. That is a long and complicated story to tell. And those of us who are revolutionary socialists, despite loud, strident assertions, the contrary often, which passes for analysis of the left, which often passes for analysis of the left, have not really figured this out. These are some of the most interesting theses to discuss, and I hope we can do this in discussion period. There are no question that this is the most important topic for us.
Let me go next. Well, first of all, let me congratulate you all for this remarkable day. The panels I attended this morning and this afternoon were superb, and it's been my experience with meetings that I've spoken at for Platypus here and in Toronto and most recently in Halifax, the way in which you bring together young people to try to develop yourselves as organic intellectuals of a new revolutionary movement, to to use Gramsci's term, is really impressive. That on a spring day like today, you've really proven that you've got what the Germans call Sitzfleisch. Well-boned flesh on your rear ends. I have to admit, I skipped out. It was a tremendous session halfway through the Q&A of the last session on labor and state, because I just felt I deserved some fresh air, and I walked over Millennium Park and over the unfortunately named Maggie Daly Bridge to the Riverside Walk, and it was marvelous. So. And I came back, and you were all standing in the corridors talking. It was very impressive. Secondly, the second thing that's remarkable about these meetings is that, unlike most gatherings of this sort, where you're asked to come and speak, or you propose to come and speak on a general theme, Platypus gives you very, very detailed marching orders. They spend a lot of time telling you what to read and what questions to. So for this one, they virtually instructed us to go back and read Rosa Luxemburg's Talking Revolution. which is her critique of Bernstein, begun in 1898. And, you know, it's been said that all of the important debates within Marxism, strategic debates, took place between 1898 and 1903. And I have to admit, I don't think I've read Reform and Revolution since I was your age. That's 40 or 50 years ago. It was probably in 1977, 6 or 7. And, you know, you assume you know it. So when I sat down and read it, I was surprised by how much I disagreed with Rosa. I very much agreed instinctively as a young person and to this day with her critique of Bernstein. But I now felt that there was a great deal in Rosa's discourse and conceptualization that I found very, very problematic. I want to talk about both the positive and negative aspects of the critique of reformism that Rosa made. But before I do that, I want to say a couple of words about liberalism. First of all, liberalism in its classic form, Hobbes, Locke, Smith, Ricardo, is really what is called neoliberalism today. It's what the organic intellectuals of capitalism, mostly embedded in university economics departments, are practicing. It's in no sense democratic. It has nothing to do with what liberal democratic theorists were talking about as they developed through the course of the 19th century. It's about the efficiency of markets. It's about microeconomic relations between consumer demands for utilities and the supply of them, etc. What occurred through the course of the 19th century, and to some extent it began late 18th century, of course, but what occurred through the course of the 19th century was that liberal democratic theorists brought to liberalism a notion of man, and it was really man, and it still was property man in a certain way, although it extended to small property owners and householders. Certainly didn't extend to women who were the property of men, and as is obvious in the American case, to blacks who were the property of whites, at least of the slave owners. But a conception of man as a doer, an exerter, but above all, of a developer of capacities through the practice of democracy. Insofar as John Stuart Mill wasn't in favor of mass suffrage or women's suffrage, it was because that the state had not developed them enough to have the capacities to be practitioners of democracy, the development of capacities to be such. Of course, the realization of liberal democracy was not achieved by liberal democratic theorists, nor even by the bourgeois parties that absorbed their thinking and their strategic orientation. It was only achieved through the course of, at least in most countries, less so in the United States, but at least for male suffrage, in most countries, in the development of the modern labor movement through the course of the 19th century. And not least through the formation, and I'll talk about this in plenary later, of these unique political institutions, entirely new in history, of permanent organizations of the largest subordinate class, the working class, that is, the socialist and communist parties, who, you know, at the top of their programmatic demand were universal suffrage and women's suffrage. It's too often forgotten, the emancipation of women. Whether they prioritize that enough in their actual practice is quite another question, of course. But at the top of their programs, and that was very important to the achievement of it. It's why, you know, in Australia, you get universal suffrage, including women's suffrage, first, because of the importance of the Labour Party. Very much a Bernsteinian reformist Labour Party. But nevertheless, that's where it happened, where you properly get universal suffrage. Let's leave that aside, although it says something, of course, about what John Stuart Mill would think about what liberal democracy has achieved to see Trump elected. Indeed, to have seen the panoply of Republican candidates to which he was subjected in the course of this election campaign. He, as much as any Marxist, would have torn his hair up at what this proved about the extent to which liberal democracy in practice does not develop democratic capacity. Now, to turn to reform and revolution, of course, the most important statement at the beginning of it, of Luxembourg's response to Bernstein, is, of course, it's a false opposition to counterpose reform against revolution. There is no path to revolution without reform. We revolutionaries have no purchase vis-a-vis the working classes unless we can speak to the possibility of reform. And moreover, the importance of liberal democracy is it provides space within which we can do that. That's how she opens. Second, she recognizes far too few, I think, insurrectionists do, that there is a tension between the short term and the long term, which is very difficult to resolve. Very difficult to resolve. I confronted it myself in the mid-1990s when I was asked to help the FMLN develop themselves into a political party from a guerrilla movement in El Salvador, political party, and to come and speak to a party school that was being developed. And I was sitting with the woman who ran that school, Angela Samora, who had been a leader in the guerrilla movement in the early 80s, and the guy who had been the subcomandante on the San Salvador volcano. You kidding? Or we started, maybe I won't tell you the story. Anyway, he said, look, we have a complete misconception of what is short-term or what is long-term. We think long-term is the election in 1999. In fact, that's a short-term whereby we have to hope that we are the kind of party that can sustain itself as a representative of the people. The medium term is 2010, in which we have to hope that we have some hegemonic purchase in the society, and long-term is 2020, at which point we have to hope that we can enter the state in one way or another and actually transform it. And Angela Samora said, in that case, I'm leaving the party. I can't go back to the people that I've been a guerrilla leader of since 1981 and tell them they need to wait till 2020. Which is why you understand the impatience of the revolutionaries in 1917. Okay, I've only got 2 minutes, so let me say something very good. Luxembourg nails what happened to social democracy. Absolutely nails it. Nails that in the struggle for reform, the Bernsteinian tendency will make accommodations to alliances with the bourgeoisie, with their representatives, with the personnel in the bureaucratic and technocratic state, of a kind which will mean that those reforms don't lead on to openings for transformation. That they, in fact, will reproduce capitalism as a social order, which is exactly what happened to social democracy, including the Democratic Party, which there's no distinction between the Democratic Party, given its alliance to the labor bureaucracy, and any European social democracy, and hasn't been, arguably, since the Great Depression, but certainly since the 1980s. Luxembourg evinces all kinds of problems as I look at it. Part of her pillorying of Bernstein is about that he doesn't get socialism as a historic necessity. Why is it a historical necessity? Because capitalism must break down. Not just have pricing. Not just, of course, not be able to overcome its irresolvable contradiction, but must break down. Well, in 2017, what can one say about that? Given the longevity, the staying power, the adaptability of capitalism. Not least in this crisis. We are not living in the Great Depression despite the nature, the depth nature of this crisis. The fourth great crisis of capitalist history. The first great crisis of the 21st century. What happened? Well, they used neoliberal monetary policy to contain the crisis, not least through the capacity of the American state to be a firefighter, which is the term used in the Treasury and the Federal Reserve for what they do. They are firefighters. Capitalism doesn't break down in itself. Now, it's possible that Rosa doesn't mean by historical necessity that it will inevitably happen in that teleological sense. It might mean that it is a necessity because otherwise we will live in barbarism. And it's not impossible, given the climate crisis on top of capitalism's inevitable tendency to produce crises in its current form, that we will be living in a world that looks like Blade Runner. But that doesn't mean it will end. So, now, when Rosa gets right, is the notion of the party as the developer of class capacity. That's what she gets right. And that's what she is most critical of Bernstein for. That said, she engages in, as I think we can hear Marxists engaging in 2017, at least at this meeting, in an uncritical discussion of the notion of state transformation in terms of the term of dictatorship, in terms of the term of the smashing of the state and the withering away of the state. She doesn't actually use those terms, but she does use dictatorship. And these are the three most problematic concepts in Marxist strategy. One understands what is meant by them, they're important, but they sweep all of the difficult questions of capacity development by the working class and the transformation of the state under the carpet. Of course, what it means is the bourgeoisie tells the capitalist state what to do, it dominates it, it controls it. The socialist world will presumably tell some sort of public order. The working class will tell some sort of public order what to do. Now, they don't want to call it a state because the state, of course, dominates society in pre-capitalist society. But, as Marx says to Bakunin, well, of course, there'll be all kinds of layers of level administration and representation. And in frustration, finally, in his debate with Bakunin in the 1870s, he says, if you want to call it a state, call it a state. But just as the absent Marxist theory of the state, of the capitalist state, leads to the absurd notion that a capitalist class which is internally divided
knows what its common interest is and instructs the state to do it, rather than understands the capitalist state as a agglomeration of institutions which over time becomes internally capitalist in its own administrative formation. So that it's not a matter of capitalists telling the Department of Labor what to do. It's that if you get a job in the Department of Labor and you act in ways that will help this guy in a class struggle, rather than attempt to, at best, secure some class harmony, rather than conduct a class struggle, they'll make you sweep the floors. It doesn't fit with what the institution does. It's not a matter of capitalists phoning them up. Now, that evolved over time. Well, the Marxist, Marx understood that if you read Volume 1 of Capital with regard to the structure of capitalism. But no time has been spent by Marxists until about 1965, 67, 68 in trying to develop a Marxist theory of the state. I was lucky enough to study with Miliband, was part of that, and devoted most of my intellectual work to that. Okay. But beyond that, and I'll finish with this, the problem relates to state transformation. The problem relates to what types of capacities need to be developed to be able to go into the state and change the representative and administrative apparatus so that people inside the state continue to be developers, educators, organizers of people's capacity. And what happened in the Russian Revolution? And Lenin said it in 1923-24, his last testament, was that the Russian state has defeated us. It wasn't a matter of the Soviets and the Duma. It was that when these intellectuals and indeed advanced workers went in to run state departments, maybe with the exception of Trotsky and the army, they represented those departments. The Bolshevik Party and the USSR administration was not a unified core. On the contrary, every figure in it was representing his particular state interest, the institutional interests of the different branches of the state.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll finish with that. But I think that what I'm trying to get at there, I'll just finish with this, is that if we are in fact going to develop new parties in the 21st century, we have to, of course, take what was positive about Luxembourg and Lenin and Trotsky, etc. But we absolutely need to transcend the mistakes, misconceptions, tensions, contradictions in that thought.
Okay. This coffee's only going to last 10 minutes, so. I just got a bus, bear with me. I'm a bus driver for the Chicago Transit Authority. I'm an elected executive board member for the Bus Drivers Union. I'm now been a transit union local 241. So, a lot's going on. I'll get to that in a minute. But basically, I'm a fill-in. So, I give a speech on liberalism. I feel like it's the Cuban Revolution, and Che Guevara is with a whole bunch of Fidel Castro and a whole bunch of revolutionists and saying, they just took the capital. They're like, oh shit, what do we do? So someone says to, hey, is anyone an economist here? Anyone a good economist? And Che's like, Che, really, you're an economist? Oh, I thought you said a good communist. So I can, from that perspective, I can speak on this. I did study brother here, I read Luxembourg and a lot of his works, you know, 10-15 years ago. I studied with Platypus for several summers. I really enjoyed that. I missed all the classes we did together. But it is really impossible, in my opinion, to think clearly if you're not in the middle of the struggle. It's just, I was on my bus today, And I was like, man, I've got to write a theoretical work right now because we don't understand this or whatever, right? You know, but I do think you have to do both. So I really appreciate you inviting me off this to this event and forcing me and everyone here to think through these questions. So just real quickly, I think it was already said, I was fired last February from my job, and this was the greatest thing because they made me a full-time organizer. Instead of driving a bus about 4 or 5 times a day and doing my union work, now I got to go all over the world and do international solidarity and meet revolutionists in Korea, in Japan, in Brazil, and watch their work. And like, man, you got fired? Right on, you're one of us. So let's go into the regular meetings and let's talk about how we're doing things. But seriously, we in Korea, there was a mass mobilization every week of over 1 million people. Just a week or two ago, they just deposed the president. She's in jail now for putting all this labor reforms, attacking the working class. In Brazil right now, they have a national general strike on the 28th of this month. Just the 15th, it was major mobilizations going on. So it was wonderful to be in these places. So that's the perspective I want to come from, in addition to my work in the Chicago Transit Authority, about what is liberalism, what is revolution, from like a 10-year history of remembering what I read theoretically. Okay, so the question asks, I've been asked to be very clear about what to talk about. So how do both camps fall short of the fulfillment of all liberal desiderata? Now, I have to admit I had to look that word up. Sorry. I understand it's something that is desired by the liberals. But it was kind of ironic. I wasn't sure what you guys were referring to, both camps. Which camps are you talking about? Are you talking about Sanders versus Clinton? Or are you talking about reformists versus revolutionists? And the fact that I couldn't figure that out, I think that says something itself. But I think that's what we're talking about. What is revolutionist, right, as opposed to reformist? And that's at least partially from my recollection what Rosa Luxemburg was referring to. So I understand this back from college days, liberalism was this thing in the 18th and 19th century that was talking about the freedom of the individual. I'm sorry, I think everyone in this room knows more about this than I do. That's what I understood to be, you guys will correct me. But my understanding is that in the 19th century, there became a possibility for the first time in history for this to be real. And with the Industrial Revolution, with the social labor going all over the world, that it was possible. And this, my tradition comes from Marxism. This was the identification that Marx and others pointed out was possible and was trying to build the politics, the revolutionary struggle to actually make that happen. That's my understanding. But it was, and I try to answer the same question. How can people live a raised life? How can we get out of this crisis of the 1840s when people were starving and it was people super wealthy? And how can we get out of this lack of reason in society that's so immoral to us? In the starving 1840s as well. Okay, so my understanding of the project, which is the same thing I thought Rosa was trying to say, is look, we got to talk about what the goal is. We got to fight for the goal. And my perspective is the goal is still to, is the possibility is to form a world society where there's no longer an artificial scarcity of material necessities, where the world cultural level is risen dramatically. The human culture, right? The ability to read and write, the ability to understand the long history of humanity, natural history, the cultural level of humanity, which is the fastest way you can get there is not in university. It's actually where people have no access to anything, right? Not just written word, but food and free time and light. And, those basic necessities that are the precondition to having culture, of not just being slammed by material existence, right? And so here we have this great abundance. I won't talk about capital, but you know, that's what fundamentally, in my opinion, Marxism discussed in the 19th century. Okay, next question. Back to the text there. What would it take for left to define itself beyond liberal politics? How can the left oppose the establishment parties without simply replacing them? Well, not much time. I will just make a few points. It's got to be centered on the working class. There's many reasons for this, and I'd love to work with anybody here about a theoretical recent discussion of this, but basically, the working class has the legitimate authority and the strength to be independent enough to form a power that can do this, that can form a government, and can form a national and international governments to see this through, and to put the massive capital machines towards the purpose of producing enough of the food, housing, and cultural level. That be the focus of our governments. And that's why, in my opinion, well, not just my opinion, but the historical record and, if you will, scientific socialism argues that this is the direction we should take. Yes, as the document discussed, and as several brothers here talked about, there has been a long history, which we'd have to dialectically develop about how we got to this point of why the working class has not been combative enough in this country, why the organizations that we put forward have not been up to the task. Okay, so I'm going to get to the practical stuff because I got four minutes. I wanted to talk briefly about, and ask permission to talk about this, about an experience I had in Brazil, as practically what I saw as immediately useful to us in the United States. Part of the discussion was about how do we deal with people's movements versus working class. I talked about the old left talking, okay, we're going to be class-centered, we're not going to talk about black, we're not going to talk about women, or ethnicity, or all that. Okay, now they did in practice in the early 2000s, so long story short, you have to take a look at this. Basically, the Workers' Party came to power, and it became reformist, right? Lula and all that. And then there was a fight against the reformist party that was in power, right? The Bernstein and so on, right? And there was a fight back against the labor attack on labor law. You know, they were trying to attack people's pensions. We lost, but it was a national coordinating committee of the millions of workers in Brazil. Now, the coordinating committee stayed. We lost the battle, but the coordinating stayed, and a bunch of communists and others were able to help steer it to become a national coordination, and became this group called CSD Com Lutas. The reason why I'm so excited about this group is because it combined with people's movements with a majority working class organization. So they have a landless movement, which is a major movement in Brazil. They have specific African caucuses, if you will, organizations, women's, LGBTQ, etc., that are part of this, but it was limited to about 10 or 15% of voting delegates. It was able to get into a minority position in many of what they call yellow unions or class collaborationist unions, right? I'm in one of those right now. I would love to have a national organization that can assist people like me and my friends to form a caucus in my local, to have a national banner to say, hey, what happens in San Francisco, what happens in Miami or New York? That's my guys, right? You know, they're kicking some ass over here, and you know, even my five people in the Chicago Transit Authority, the ATU. We all somehow look bigger. And that's how they were able to grow to a 3 or 5 million member organization. And I think we should look to that. I'm helping to organize a conference in about 6 months. If there's a major fight back in the United States, if there's a major strike wave, then there'll be the capacity to form some kind of organization that does practical work of solidarity between cities. Okay, so I guess that's where I was going to finish out. I'll say one. I got 30 seconds left. Can I give a pitch real quick? We have a press conference on Monday morning. We're fighting the city. We have several workers. They fired me, and they tried to kick out the union. They failed. They had the cops in my bus garage for a while. They kicked me out. They kicked the union out. But we were able to win that back. We have these unfair labor practices against some of this stuff. We're finally getting our day in court. That's on Monday at 160 North LaSalle Street. And we're going to get it back. We're going to pack the courtroom with workers. You guys are all welcome to come. But like I said, I'd love to talk with anyone here afterwards and in the discussion about some of this theoretical work and also organizational work. Thank you.
Thank you for everyone for, yes, coming to this panel, and thank you, Platypus. I think it's the third time, perhaps, right? So we have to keep moving like this. thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Today morning session was amazing, and some of you, those of you who were there, might hear sort of, you know, bits and pieces from that process of talks as well. So I'm just going to, you know, I'm essentially trying to address last part of the set of questions: how is the lack of a self-conscious left opens the way for regressive movements to fill the void of emancipatory politics? And what I'd like to talk about today is the left and memory, and the left in perennial quotation marks. But I want to talk about the left and memory, not in relation to war and history, given where we are today in this particular time, well, as we have been for a long time, although those are important topics, but in relation to the absolute here and now, our physical occupation, as it were, of this particular space, literal and otherwise, in the bowels of the neoliberal university. In particular, I want to think about how the university as it exists today, mostly in the neoliberal liberal shambles, and the ways in which it is, or rather, some of its more privileged members are seeking to rescue its image as the site for clear, rational discourse, and more importantly, radical thought and action. And I want to think about and question the university's current, in this moment of crisis, the university's current rehistoricizing itself as a liberatory space. I want to think, currently, most of this is being framed in national conversations and international conversations as a neoliberal university breaks down in terms of academic freedom. The argument is made that the university is one of, if not the last site for such. And this is not just a social media discussion, by the way. This is very much a set of conversations going on within universities and around them. And I want to ask over and over again in all of this, implicitly, what does academic freedom, that very concept, mean when 75% of faculty across the board are not, in fact, tenured or even tenure-track faculty? Where the existence of academic freedom is also determined across the vectors of race and gender, factors that sectors of the left today, unfortunately, would like to discount. I'm also thinking about class and the university and how the university has historically been a way for some people to attain a certain degree of social mobility and what that means, at least in the United States. The role that the university has played in that, it has become fashionable of late for portions of the left, such as it is, to discount the importance of what contemptuously refers to as identity. Mostly these days, when the left talks about identity, what it really means is race. I'm talking very fast, it will be up on my website sometime. Mostly these days, when the left talks about identity, what it really means is race. Gender and even sexuality have quietly left the room, it seems. But what does it mean for a non-white, we're talking about academic freedom, what does it mean for a non-white, even male academic, like Stephen Salaita, to tweet with the assumption of academic freedom and to, in effect, then be subject to more or less eternal exile from the university system? His current position is an impermanent one. In contrast to, say, George Citarello Meyer, who continues, and I hope I haven't butchered his name, I apologize, who continues to tweet with relative impunity and has even started to carve out an alternative career for himself as macho campus radical. And for those of you who don't know the situation, George Citarello Meyer on December 26th, as I recall, sent out a tweet saying, all I want for Christmas is white genocide. And that created a huge furor among some on the right. But not to return, to return then briefly to identity, I have been and am among the loudest critics of diversity and identity politics. But there has to be a difference between critiquing the deployment of identity to further the reach of capitalist exploitation and actually engaging the dense, compacted, painful history of identities that still exist within the capitalist system. The the wishful thinking in parts of the left is that the advent of a more just and egalitarian society will come about with matters like racism having automatically worked themselves out. But it has nothing to say about what we have to say in the here and now, how to contend with the stark and often physical realities of race and racism. For instance, while we plod our way towards this rosy Star Trek future, I'm a fan, by the way, most of my ongoing work is about thinking through the contested and contestatory space of the university. And like many on the anti-intellectual left and right, I don't think the university system needs to be raised to the ground, or that what it can produce, but does less so these days, is useless. And even if it is useless, I still think there is a reason to continue with it. I just wanted to make that clear. But the left has a historically complicated and often fragile link to the university. And I know that everyone in the campus understands that really well. The irony is that much of left thinking has, in fact, of course, come about outside the university system. But, and this is a huge but, the other irony is that today the defense of the university as a site of macho radical posturing is coming about through the creation of the fiction of an intellectual class of sorts that, in fact, no longer exists. I want to press upon this, so bear with me. So when Cicerello Maher set about apparently just demolishing and vanquishing the alt-right fascists with his white genocide tweets, few would note that, contrary to what he and his supporters implied or insisted, white genocide, the term, was not in fact some well-known concept that everyone should have understood as satire. As a colleague of mine pointed out, the only people who could have understood the term in context would have been white ultra-racists. Yet, on Democracy Now!, the story was picked up and presented, taken seriously, and not contesting the professor's contention that the satire was well understood. I want to tease out what this means for a minute. Democracy Now!, which is sort of like PBS for the socialist crowd, was representative, and marked with affection, was representative of many, perhaps most, of his supporters outside. This is very important to consider, that he garnered a lot of support from non-university people outside the university system for whom chortling, especially in a in a new Trump era, for these people who were chortling about how clueless these white right-wingers were about the satire was a way for them to align themselves with an academic with whom they could now claim kinship and affinity. It was also a way for many to demonize and render the alt-right in the usual contemptuous terms that are reserved for white and lower class people in particular. Which is to say, central to the quote-unquote white genocide controversy was an enactment of solidarity on and against class lines, solidified under the pretense that some great and intellectual mode of satire had been badly missed by the untutored masses. This was, in short, a moment about class ascension. I want to emphasize, I cannot emphasize enough, the fact that a dying system, the neoliberal university, is resurrecting itself in such moments, not through actual radical acts of intervention, such as supporting the BDS movement, which is growing in some places, or through demanding that perhaps graduate students at an expensive private school like Drexel make more than the $23,000 they currently make. But through such messy moments of effectively enacting class hierarchy, snarking at the stupidity of people who did not understand a satirical tweet, barely understood as such, even by supporters, is akin to making fun of people for not grasping the obscure points of a fine opera. I am not claiming that the white genocide moment is symptomatic of massive large encounters, but it is one significant cultural moment, the sort of which is growing, in which the university has landed disastrously. And it is symptomatic of the ways in which, for some vocal insiders, the only way to justify the university's existence is to establish its superiority of yokels outside the gates. There's a tendency, and I want you to now move on. I'll just cut out a bit about the Art Institute of Chicago and its but I do want to say, just very quickly, to think about this institution's place, not just in the art world, but as a key global center in the movement of capital. People tend to dismiss fashion and art But when you think about what art, especially since you're also paranoid about Russian oligarchs, think about what art does, right, for the oligarchy, how it has historically served to consolidate class power and class ascension. So I find the art industry very interesting for that reason. But I want to move instead to quickly to the University of Chicago, located in my own neighborhood of Hyde Park, to understand the complicated history of the U of Chicago is to understand the complicated history of Hyde Park itself, a history that both affirms and calls into question what we know and understand about, what we know and understand about race and race relations in America. With that dramatic point, she shuffled her pages. I often refer to the University of Chicago as a neighborhood that looks like not quite ye olde England. Founded in 1890 by John D. Rockefeller, as you all probably know, it's designed to emulate Oxford. At orientation, students are warned never to go south of 63rd and to never cross Washington Park. In other words, this is a neighborhood that has been historically marked by very intense race relations. And it is also, the university also employs one of the country's largest private security forces in America, the University of Chicago Police Department, UCPD. As a recent article in Vice put it, in a report on the UCPD's racial profiling practices in Hyde Park, it has the legal status of a private police force and the powers of a public one. The University of Chicago is one of the major landowners and landlords in the neighborhood. Very few decisions about who rents where can be made without the UFC's permission. That's something to keep in mind. There are military, I think of it as Hyde Park as both a company town and a military installation, with armed guards at most corners, outside establishments, even like Starbucks, because heaven forbid anyone run away with a free grande cappuccino. So in Hyde Park, the largest narrative about Hyde Park has been that there has been a long-term collusion. This is a very complicated history we can tease out later. But the collusion has been between a professional black, a class of professional black people and the University of Chicago to keep lower class white and black people out. That has been sort of the historical narrative that has often been spun out. Now, there is obviously some truth to that. But the other problem with all of this is that it doesn't recognize, I'm going to take a couple of minutes. The other problem with this is that it doesn't recognize the history of gentrification, which was actually involved within restrictive covenants. In other words, housing in Hyde Park and actually much of the city was legally mandated that it could not be sold or rented to non-white people. Right? And that changed in 1948. And with that, Hyde Park became this very interesting sort of spot in the middle of an otherwise very fractured set of racial relations in the city. So it was the only place, actually, in that area, and for a while, even in Chicago, where blacks could comfortably, and comfort is important, we like to think it's not, but it is important, could comfortably live, right, with their families, as opposed to being burned out of their houses, or worse, in neighboring, say, Bridgeport, right, which is the birthplace of the Daleys. So, what we want to think about is the relationship of universities to their built environments, right? But we also want to think about what the history of universities has been in terms of thinking through what we consider the radical potential of the university. So then we might then say, well, it's the University of Chicago, it's the birthplace of Milton Friedman, right? How can we expect U of Chicago, after all, to be anything but horrific in all these particular instances? So then we might look to, California, Berkeley. And we might say, well, here's a university with an incredible radical history, and look what happened when Milo, who has now disappeared into obscurity, when Milo showed up, there were actual riots, there was violence. And so within that moment, you will have noticed, I'm sure, that there was this return to this narrative of nostalgia, in a sense, for the history of Berkeley, and also for the sort of return of the radical university, right? Just this insistence that the university can still be a place where people like Milo are shut down. But we might then want to remember that Milo disappeared not because of riots, right? Milo disappeared because he screwed up big time. Milo disappeared because he went from being a cute queer guy to a gay man who spoke openly about intergenerational sex. That's what drove him out. So it wasn't the rioting, it wasn't the radicals on campuses that drove Milo out. It was his own unfortunate positioning within a very controversial topic. So, you know, and to end with this, you know, the question is, the question for us, I think, should not be how do we recover the university, because university has historically, actually, for many centuries, been a very complicated place. It has been, yes, things like, we've had things like the GI Bill, for instance. It has granted certain kinds of social mobility, but it's also been, in a way, a way to think about and mask, right, the degradation of neighborhoods, for instance. So there's this complicated history of the university. And I think, as we face a new and uncertain future, a number of us would like to remind everyone, perhaps, that this is, in fact, actually a very old future, even a shop-worn future, a future that was endlessly replayed for us, especially over the last 8 years. And again, there's a sort of forgetting that's involved right now in this historical moment, especially, for instance, as war supposedly breaks out, right, which is itself a kind of a forgetting. If we are to imagine how to move forward, it's best that we imagine a future beyond the inevitability of our fables of the past.
We'll have the speakers respond to each other. Instead, let's say about 2-3 minutes, just point out a couple interesting things that you'd like, and then we'll leave plenty of time for the Q&A. Is that okay? We can do the same order that we have today.
My own sort of only bone to pick, in terms of the thing that is most interesting, I'm sorry. The bone I have to pick with Leo is about the state in which he's an expert and I'm sort of an unknown. So I'm coming at it from a disadvantage.
Yeah, you're a mathematician, so you think much more logically.
But the question of, he thinks that the issue of dismantling the state, the bourgeois state, is a fake issue. You can't do it. That it misunderstands the nature of the role of the state. And that perceives the, somehow the socialist movement, my point that the workers' movement has to work around this, in some sense, eventually transform the state, but it can't make the state its target. I think this is wrong. I think that the politics is where the working class movement, the revolutionary movement, must go. That has to be the center of our concerns. And once you raise that issue of politics, then you're raising the issue of the state and who controls it, and whether, what aspects of it has to be smashed. And so that, you know, I guess I would reply to, in some sense, is non-political analysis of the role of the state, which bothers me. I have no particular quarrel with them. I think they were interesting. I'm not sure they dealt with the issue of the state, but they dealt with the issues they raised very well.
The state was the previous panel.
Well, I mean, when you talk about Rosa Luxemburg and liberalism versus, I mean, it might be liberal versus socialism, you've got to raise.
I spent too much time complimenting platypuses. I'm sure there'll be other questions on this. I don't think we disagree. Now, I don't think we should avoid this thing. I think the capacities that socialist parties need to develop, that bus drivers need to, unions need to develop, is the capacity to be able to go into the state and transform its modes of administration and representation for a socialist end, which I think that we have neglected as Marxists, thinking that all we have to do is take a hammer and walk and smash it.
Well, I guess we're talking about this, so I'll talk about it real quick. This was really a practical question in Brazil and Korea when I was there, and especially in Brazil right now and Argentina, is what is the way forward if it is to grasp the state and to take it over and to somehow run this, you know, people's direction, kind of like Venezuela in a way still, or is it to actually smash it and build a new state? And if that's the case, then what organs of actual power to do that? So you need to run the water. You need to have food and transportation. How are we going to do it immediately? Right? It's a practical question. In the Russian Revolution, that we look towards history, we have the Soviets that acted as a dual power, right? To a degree, right? The peasantry was in the Soviets, an army, in the countryside, and of course the factories. The United States, what do we have? Labor unions, we have churches, some community organizations, but there's no organ that, at this moment, that I know of, that can begin to act as a power that can do what is necessary for society. And that's what we need to do. We can't just smash the state and not have food, right? So that was the other practical question in Brazil and Korea, which I just came back from, was, of course, the U.S. Empire would come and smash you if you took power. And there's 28,000 U.S. troops in the middle of Korea. So this has nothing to do with North Korea. It has to do with South Korea that they're there, going after the quote-unquote nuclear weapons. They're afraid of South Korean working class because they all have to be in the military for several years. I went to a strike of transit workers for 73 days, right? And, man, my union meetings are so tepid compared to sitting down in military formation as they discuss they sing songs about the martyrs in the 1980s when they were able to remove the dictatorship, and have sit down strikes all over the country, very warfare conditions, class battles peaking, yet they're not discussing power. First, because they came in, the state came in and smashed up their Workers' Party political organization, right? Try to be Bernstein and all. No, they came in and wrecked it, made it illegal. You all a bunch of communists. You go back to North Korea, right? And threw a whole bunch of people in jail. But otherwise, you have a serious discussion. How the heck can we have a workers' government or a people's government, whatever you want to call it, without the U.S. military or the Japanese military coming in and bombing the heck out of you, like they've done all over Southeast Asia? So, and the same thing with Brazil. This was the practical questions. It wasn't just the dismantling of the state or not. These are just to discuss on that thing. One thing, I wish you could have talked more about the critique. This is your best point about the critique of equality that you talked about. I love bringing that up in the discussion. But other than that, on that topic, I appreciate your comments.
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of the state, it's read around. I don't know if you ask about me, I don't ask about her, but that's all right, she's. I want to, in terms of the state, it doesn't really matter anymore whether a university is private or not. The presence of the state in the university system is especially becoming apparent with universities take on things like Title IX. And issues like how sexual harassment, for instance, is treated, and the apparatus of surveillance technology in particular, right? The Laura Kipnis and others write about the sexual aspect of all of that. What I want to think about and what I want to be theorizing about is how universities, whether it's Columbia or whether it's UIC, are engaged in surveillance technologies, but are also engaged in establishing within their campuses sort of partial NGOs, and also how they are plugged in. So with the whole sex trafficking hysteria, they're also plugged into a multinational global push to quote unquote end sex trafficking. Much of that has actually to do not just with policing women's bodies, but with actually establishing international networks of local surveillance, for instance, and of course the policing, literally, but the ways in which international and national state policing get conflated in time. So there's a way in which the presence of the state at universities now has become palpable and also not palpable, invisible and also very visible. So I think we need to sort of be aware of that, especially because things like sexual harassment and sex trafficking are seen as, you know, gendered, right? So this is casting that sort of feminine space of campuses. There's that. I think that's really what I wanted to just raise.
Right. So,
Andrew.
Great. Leo, I wanted to take up this. There was a statement. I'm not sure how committed you are to it, but you made a comment that like Adam Smith and neoliberalism have very close affinities. Yet I think, as Yasmin has pointed out, liberalism is degrading. There's a way in which the PC kind of form of liberalism is not the New Deal liberalism, and it's not the liberalism, Cold War liberalism, where you point out someone like McPherson can still recognize Marxism. And have a recognition of Marxism, which seems impossible today. And so I wonder, the other point was, you know, if the new left will, at Berkeley, will uphold free speech, but then will burn the a sign with that free speech on it in the present. Like, there seems to be some such degradation. And so I was thinking about this question of barbarism, that it's not something like, you know, that there's a way in which the kind of practical, independent organization in civil society has become, you know, since 1917 seems to have become worse. And so so I was kind of, yeah, so do you?
I entirely agree.
Okay.
I agree 100% with what you just said. And it may indeed, I mean, Rosa was clearly wrong to say in 1898 that liberal democracy had run its course. Mm-hmm. It had stopped being useful for the capitalists, she says to Bernstein. You're wrong to think that workers are going to be able to continue to develop their strength within a liberal democratic framework. It takes Gramsci to say, just a few years after the Bolshevik Revolution, in fact, you won't be able, as Engels said in 1896, to secure an insurrection in modern advanced capitalist societies, which are deeply, where the state is deeply embedded in their society, with those kinds of linkages. She might be more right today. I think what we are seeing is a development of deep authoritarian tendencies in what were liberal democracies. And tragically, and it's a reflection of the failure of both social democracy and the communist movement, and to some extent we're seeing this in Brazil, most tragic. Given that there you had a post-Leninist, post-social democratic mass working class party, but then didn't know what to do when it got inside the state. It said it was going to continue to be a cadre, continue to be an organizer, and it didn't. And now you're seeing an authoritarian right come to power with a good deal of support from the very people who voted PT. We'll have to see whether it sustains itself, of course. It may not. So I think there are deep authoritarian tendencies, and that's reflected in universities in many ways, amongst the very, you know, disciplines that are producing organic intellectuals for the capitalist class. You know, if you want to talk about economics departments in terms of the quality of intellectuals, they can't hold a candle to Smith or Ricardo, let alone to even Hayek and Keynes. It's astonishing how intellectually impoverished economics departments are today. So, I mean, I guess I agree entirely.
Pam.
Thank you. This came up at the last panel, and since you talked about the state, I wanted to You said that the dictatorship of the proletariat, the withering away of the state, is some of the most problematic concepts in Marxism. And Bill Peltz at the last panel quoted Lenin that the state should become the kind of coordinator of things. I'm misquoting, the coordinator of things, not people, like the post office, this kind of thing. And I was just hoping that you could expand on why is it that the socialists need to take state power? Like, why is it that this is a necessary transition for the possibility of communism? I was reading the Hal Draper on the dictatorship of the proletariat, and he points out how Marx in the 19th century is critiquing the Blanquists, that their conception of the dictatorship is through a putsch. And Marx says the dictatorship of the proletariat is not a putsch, it's the dictatorship of a class over another class. And so it's a sort of temporary situation under which you could do away with the social relations of the bourgeoisie. So what would that look like? Why is it necessary? Yes.
Are you asking me?
I'm asking
or,
all
or
of the panelists and whoever wants to answer.
Okay, yeah. The issue in my mind is the how do you exercise the power of the working class except through some kind of state? My point, along with Lenin, is that you've got to smash the existing state because you can't exercise workers' power through the existing state. It's structured in such a way to to forbid that, to stop that. And this is where my disagreement with Lewis. But that without possessing, the state is the force of coercion, military force. If you try to take power without possessing state, the army will come in and crush you. I mean, it's a fact. And that's historical. And so how do you do that? Even perhaps, the Bolsheviks took the state. The Chinese revolutionaries battled the capitalist state for many, many years, but they defeated them militarily. They formed their own state and swept away that. Even in Cuba, it was a short battle, but they swept away the old bourgeois state and built themselves a new state as fast as they could, because otherwise they couldn't hold power. The working class could not hold power within the confines of the old state. So my answer is that if you want workers' power, you've got to construct a workers' state.
Because I'd run out of time, I had said I thought that each three elements of that conception, dictatorship, withering, and smashing, had understandable and positive elements. But they also swept all the difficulties under the carpet. The kind of stuff that Marx spent three volumes, and way more, trying to work through in terms of the complexities of understanding of commodity exchange, corporation, etc. Those are the things not worked out in those conceptions. So, of course, it does mean that the majority will rule, and it's democratic in that sense. A minority class rules as a ruling class, and the dictatorship, and it is therefore dictatorship effective as a minority. And the working class, the majority, will rule, right? Okay, that's fine. And insofar as the state is an imposition on society rather than a democratic expression of it, then indeed one wants to do away with that. But as Marx said to Bakunin, if you mean a democratic administration, well, then we're simply talking about complex societies that go beyond the level of hunter-gathering tribes. And even in the bus drivers' union, there are complex modes of representation and administration. You can attempt to limit those, often through the incorporation of liberal elements of accountability in relation to the people you elect, the staff they appoint, etc. It's easy to say smash the state. What the Bolsheviks were discovering in January, even before February 1917, was that the soldiers, mostly peasants, were applauding workers' demonstrations in Moscow and especially Petrograd. And they had a sense, and they talked about, gee, these guys might come over to us, right? That's what made an insurrection possible. That said, they complained constantly about the imbalance inside the Soviets, even in the Petrograd Soviets, where it was much more soldiers' representation, largely because the Soviets were so haphazardly democratic. They were democratic, but you know, the means in which they were was very rough and ready, that it was often soldiers' representation which overwhelmed workers' representation. And they saw that as a problem all through 1917. Beyond that, although the Soviets were looking around to find ways to keep the factories going, to produce bread in the city, people from the Soviets were engaged in that. The effective administration from October 1917 on was never done through the Soviets. It was done through revolutionaries going into occupying the state apparatuses, sitting in those buildings, not smashing them. The bank, in the finance ministry, it was the bureaucrats who engaged in the strike. But they came back fairly quickly. Very, very little did that happen. And Lenin says by 23-24, we have become prisoners of the old Tsarist apparatus. Now, I'm not saying this is easy. You know, when P.T. Mayers got elected in 1989, when the P.T. started getting into the state, their approach was, we are cadre, we will continue to be organizers. But once they got into the state, they didn't know what the fuck to do.
What should we do?
Well, I don't have the answer to that. I'm saying we need to address that question rather than pretend it's not a question.
Well, my answer to that question is actually the answer to your second question, what should we do? Because it's, I'm sorry, speaking out loud here, or thinking out loud, but there needs to be an interrelation between the building of the new and the smashing the old. So I'm just going to take you down a bus route with me, right? So I'm driving the bus this morning on 147. In the morning, it didn't happen today, but in the morning I have to tap my badge, and the manager may tell me to come into the office for some bogus crap about they won't let me take a day off without pay for my family, right? They want to give me a write-up for this. I want to smash that place. And I defend work. I'm a union steward, so I defend workers. And there's such a huge hatred at what those managers are forced to do to us. They want to wait by the car and kill them, right? As we're getting on the bus, we're angry as hell because we just had to deal with this. We had to shut up or else we're going to get fired and lose that job. Get on the bus, right? We have to force people to get on to pay the fare. As we go by, like I down on State Street, there's a police station, right? Inside there goes on torture. Inside goes on there the enforcement of class rule, right? And the fear that you feel practically in life, that's where you're going to end up going if you step out of line. That should be smashed, right? There is no use of that place in a people's workers' government. But what will replace it? in the practice. So, you know, we don't need that damn manager. Workers could run the bus route, right? The passengers could have a committee and decide where it goes, the funding, how frequently the stop starts, and we place the pee, or the bus drivers, you know, time to pee. That we have to do both. To build the new society and also not use this instrument. I agree with what I believe Mel said about this is an instrument of class repression. Well, I think we should be open and honest about what we mean by dictatorship of proletariat. I think it's a really good term because it makes you think. Yeah, there is a dictatorship. And what is it dictating? It's dictating against the former ruling class not to kill us, right? So from the Paris Commune, where they came and murdered us, 20,000 people, right? When we had this beautiful exercise in worker democracy, And we neglected to defend ourselves, to the Russian Revolution, which was so peaceful, right? The it was legal. The actual takeover. It wasn't a putsch or something like that. It wasn't a military takeover. It was the civil war that came after, the former ruling classes that came and bloodied us. It was the 16 armies, the United States, all the world, that came in and bloodied us. It was the failure of the German Revolution, right? Of Rosa Luxemburg and other revolutionists, you know, they tried their damnedest, but the 1919 revolution didn't happen. So the point I'm trying to say is, in every experience we've had, and that's what we have to go by, is the historical experience. We have had to take state power, and we've had to use that to repress the former ruling classes. And Chile, you know, the other example, right? Democratically elected government come back and the brutality and the murder of the former ruling classes that come down. It is a period of transition that is necessary so that we can form a new society. And in every single time in history when we tried to overturn relations, the former ruling class comes in and bloodies us. That's the primary reason, in my view. But the main thing we have to do is to form the organs of worker control. How do we make decisions in the workplace? How do we make decisions in our community space? Practically. And instead of this hierarchical, top-down system of repression against us, of control from the top. Yeah, sorry. A lot to say there.
So my initial question was kind of taken up by Anne Durning, which is that, I guess, pointing out that socialism developed before Karl Marx, was born 200 years ago from liberalism, right, as a form of liberal politics. But that Marx thought, which was the, you know, political philosophy of the bourgeois revolutions, and Marx thought that in 1848 the bourgeoisie were no longer able to rule, right? And we've heard Rosa Luxemburg quoted that, you know, socialism or barbarism, such that I think, as Andoni was pointing out, it's actually unclear whether we actually have liberal politics anymore on which socialist politics could dialectically relate to and take off from. So in that regard, I'd like to train the panelists' attention back to the panel description in which Rosa Luxemburg is referred to as saying that only socialism can fulfill the desiderata of liberalism. And I'd like to ask all the panelists what they think that means. What she meant by that.
Yeah, let me comment. In Marx, something of the classical economist, he built on Adam Smith, he built on Ricardo. But that doesn't mean that we have to revive Ricardo and Adam Smith to go any further. Marx transcended them. And classical British liberalism had certain emancipatory elements to it. True. But it became a tool of a capitalist ruling class. And it is now. Therefore, to talk about going back somehow to liberalism so we can make an alliance is utopian, if you wish. It doesn't take into account the reality that exists now. That liberalism, as you said, that liberalism, like neoliberalism, which is neoliberalism, extension of liberalism, is a tool for repression. Its philosophy is a tool. It's not that it has a good philosophy but a bad, ugly practice. Its philosophy of you know, individualism or the sacredness of the market are all the tools for the repression of the working class. And therefore, you cannot go back to the liberal theorists any more than Marx can go back to Smith and Ricardo to found his analysis of capitalism and advocate for socialism.
Marx, in folding the League of Communists in the early 1850s after 1848, explained that in terms of a fundamental difference between those comrades who, if they couldn't that day bring the working class to power, would take to their beds, and those on his side who understood that what they were engaged in was a 10, 15, 20, 40-year struggle to develop the proletariat into a class. That phrase. And the question is, can one develop the proletariat into a class without freedom of association, without freedom of speech, without the political space for that to happen. It is difficult to do it underground. Not impossible, but very, very, very difficult. Rosa Sitalik, we're going to talk about this, and let's talk about Rosa's Russian Revolution pamphlet, which the Bolsheviks suppressed. She wrote it before the German Revolution was defeated. It was not translated and revealed until 1921 in Russia. But what she said was that the decision to close down the opposition parties, which was already in train just at the beginning of the Civil War, was a disastrous mistake. That without freedom of speech, freedom of association, workers would not be able to develop their capacities to be a ruling class. And Deutscher, great Trotskyist, ends his first volume of the three-volume magnificent biography of Trotsky, saying that the reason the Bolsheviks did that, and was a disastrous mistake, was that something had happened that no Marxist had ever thought was possible. That once you had won the working class to socialism, you might lose it. And what was clear through the difficult winter of 1917-18 was that it was going to be, at best, the left revolutionaries who would be elected. And it was all the more clear in 1921, after the Kronstadt rebellion, that it was probably going to be anarcho-syndicalists who would get elected. And now you can say the Bolsheviks acted that way for good reason, because, of course, they wouldn't have been able to sustain the revolution. And you would have had fascism before its time in Russia as the whites came to power. But this reflects, but you can't forget what Rosa said. You can't even identify in a modern society standing on a bus line who is a worker and who isn't, and who is petty bourgeois. Who do you pick up and say, no, you don't have the right to free speech? These are abstractions. I just wanted to say this. This is very relevant to the current moment.
We're out of time. We're already over time. So maybe we could get Aaron and Richard. Could you phrase a question so that we kind of wrap this up?
Okay, so my question is actually somewhat addressed here. But yes, I don't quite understand the criticism from Marxists about university being an elite institution. I mean, it seems to me the problem actually is the opposite, not the collaboration with the bourgeoisie of university, which is exactly what you'd expect, but the fact that radicals, the point to you and Eric, radicals are much more likely to be found in university departments nowadays than in unions, than trust groups. The part of society that would seem most has the greatest social power is not particularly individual. I mean, not they're obviously isolated cases, influenced by Marxism. Whereas the one last bastion of retreat, particularly in places like the United States, where Marxists have retreated, is the university. And I expect that within another generation, that will be swept away. So there's all this question about PC and non-PC and different forms of identity politics. I think the university, even that potential for the university to be reserved for Marxism, is something that in 30 years will probably be gone. So that's the question that I would like to address, not like the reactionary aspects of the University of Chicago, but why is it that Marxism has retreated to the university? I mean, you brought up something like BDS, which I don't think is a great success as a campaign, but BDS is a symptom of how powerless the Palestine Solidarity Movement is to get any traction outside of the university.
So can I just address that since we are running out of time? If the issue, first of all, my critique of the university is not that it's elitist. I have no interest in that particular argument at all, actually. Just as in talking about sexuality and queerness, I have no interest in positioning, for instance, queerness as inherently radical. I think we talked about that in the morning. So my critique of the university is not that it's elitist, and my critique of the University of Chicago is not that it's supremely conservative. It is to think about the University of Chicago in particular, because of its resources, because of its geographical situation, especially, I mean, literally physically and so on, because of its very complicated history, is to think about it as a a kind of a symptom of how university becomes a way to mobilize capital in ways that we don't see and understand, even as we see and understand the way it changes built environments. So my critique, that I think that the critique of the university as elitist is actually rather banal. It is not one that I would make. So that's one. Second thing is that in terms of Marxist professors, I will tell you exactly what I said to a certain Marxist professor who was once my employer, which is when he said to me, he said, but I teach Marx. And I said, as long as more than 50% of your faculty are adjuncts, your Marxism has failed. So it's not, this idea that somehow an intellectual cadre of academics are holding out the last breath of Marxist theory in the university is unsustainable. When I think about the university, my theorizing of the university is very much not as elitist or as dead, and this is not sort of, I think all of us have this complicated relationship to the university, but my relationship to it is not as something that needs to be bashed as elitist or to be revived as liberatory. It needs to think about it in more complicated ways as a kind of a set of machine, really. And how do we think of the machine moving? What parts do we dismantle? What parts do we repair as it were, if that is possible? But I think that the elitism charge is never something that I've ever made.
You mentioned this nostalgia for student activism, specifically like UC Berkeley in the 60s, something like that. And there do seem to be many activist groups that are based on campus. However, I find it hard to claim that there's any sort of socialist movement of students, nor really always liberal politics among students. So I guess I was just wondering about the left's orientation and kind of assumption about university students as some sort of radical movement.
Oh, I don't think so. In fact, this is why I was critical of the Milo incident. I pointed out that there was sort of an aura, perhaps, of insurgency and radical politics. I do want, and in relation to that, I want to sort of return to what something that Antonio raised, which was the issue of free speech and the contradiction there, right? The contradiction of shutting down at the same time claiming free speech. So what I want to do is very quickly kind of think about the issue of free speech. The idea on campus is that somehow there is this thing that we call free speech and that should flourish. At the same time that we have these things called trigger warnings, right, and this constant impulse to protect certain students from, themselves, some from the feelings they might have, and so on. And that's a contradiction, apparently, but I want us to think about that contradiction in terms of a larger scope. You were talking about the right-wing changes that we're seeing in the university, but in fact, things like Title IX, right, the return, the resurgence, the reaffirmation of Title IX, the idea that female students in particular are vulnerable, right, the vulnerability of the female student, and how that then colludes with a state machinery that comes in and criminalizes other kinds of students, often by the way, men of color, for instance, right, all the sort of complicated ways. That comes about with placing at the same time, so you have this kind of vulnerability, right? This notion of vulnerability in the student body, but you have at the same time, you have an entire class of people, 75%, right, of faculty, who are the most vulnerable economically, adjuncts. So you have the severe adjunctification, in other words, economic and then argue, correspondingly the physical vulnerability, right, of adjuncts. And you have this kind of sexual vulnerability of women, female students as being heightened. And I think, I have not really quite theorized that, but that I think historically is something that we want to look at. It is something also that Obama and Clinton, actually both Clintons, but particularly Hillary Clinton, really worked on forging in a way, that sort of weird contradiction. But to return to your idea of students, I think that where the BDS movement has been successful in places like DePaul, I think that is to be lauded, has to be encouraged. Whether it's a world, of course, university-wide change is a different matter altogether, but there are those spots. And the University of Chicago, I will also say, And I, you know, this is something to note as well. Again, these are all the contradictions. The University of Chicago students worked with students fighting for a medical trauma center on the south side. The University of Chicago has a massive amount of resources, one of the best medical schools in the world, did not fund something as simple as a trauma center for years until it was pushed to do that by the community. And U of C students did fight for that as well. They've also fought for other labor movements. So there have, you know, it's not entirely without hope, but my point again about student activism is the same point I made about queerness, which is that there's nothing inherently radical about it. And I think the problem is that we want to keep recreating this historical, you know, figure, right, of the radical student, but we have to think very contextually about it.
Okay, we have an hour till our final panel to get lunch or dinner, rather, so.